This is Pure Decking for Thursday, September the 5th, 2013. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like descending into a police state, InfoSec, and the Illuminati. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Madman, Sard, and Suave. I am drinking Jim Beam, straight. And I've got like four shots in the glass here to make it through the whole show. So we'll see how well I speak at the end of it.
What a coincidence. I am also drinking Jim Beam. And there's probably also about four shots in this glass. So cheers.
Bobby Cat. What do you got, Madman?
Woodford Reserve.
Ooh.
On the
fancy.
Rocks. Fancy. If I'm going to keep us from falling into the sun, I'm going to do it in style.
Absolutely. Sard, what do you got?
Good old standby shock top.
Combo breaker. Well, not really.
I don't know. I was drinking the Apple Crisp earlier, and that was a decent shock top.
Well, I was just thinking, we all have whiskey, and he doesn't. Well, bourbon, anyways.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of whiskey, unfortunately.
Well, we can let that slide. You do live in California. I mean...
no.
Yeah. So, it looks like most of the shows that took August off will probably be back either this week or next week. We're not sure on IHN. I think somebody was going to smack Big around and see if he was going to do Shoot the Noise, but I'm not sure on that one. So, next 2 weeks, we should start seeing all the regular shows back in rotation again. I'm planning on doing a Let's Get Drunk tomorrow, so at least my shows are back on schedule. I don't know about everybody else, but I guess that's kind of how it goes, right? So there's that. And I did get a fairly lengthy piece of feedback from Maitachi regarding running Linux full time, and I mean he sent us a small book here. So Sard, did you see the feedback he sent us on that?
I did. It had some good examples and statements.
Yeah, I mean, he really wanted to make sure we knew what he was on about. So
yep.
he was very, very, very precise. So he essentially says he's been doing the Linux full-time spiel for about half a year and has even gone so far as to completely remove Windows on his main system. Says he's running Manjaro, which is a version of Arch. And that he's never had any Pulse Audio issues, the lucky son of a bitch. Yeah. Although, to be fair with that, the last time I was serious about using Linux as my main desktop operating system, like, you know, as my full-time OS, was right around the time of when Pulse was, you know, first being implemented and the switch over to it. And, I mean, everything broke. Every fucking thing broke. It's actually on this current install, Pulse has been fine. I got it, Jack put in front of it, and they talk to each other, and it all just works. So I'm it's fine now. When they were first implementing it a couple of years ago, not so much.
That's so, what I had heard too. I personally never had any issues with it. I was thinking you might have had some issues just because if you're doing something crazy. You know, all I'm doing is plugging a headset in. That's about it, so.
Well, and exactly, for just, you know, getting your speakers working, getting a quick microphone for Skype and TeamSpeak going, it's fine. But because I'm doing some different gear, I actually had to go buy a new sound card. I had a Steinberg C1, and that thing does not work in Linux at all. It sounded great. I mean, it was very clean, very good recording interface, but... No, it, on Linux, no go. So I think I tried about three other sound cards that I had kicking around. And most of them, I mean, they worked, right? The Sound Blaster was probably the worst. I have a Creative X5 Gamer that I was using. It was just in the box because I had it installed on the Windows box. I didn't use it for that much, but I had it. And that thing was the worst. It would I guess its buffers would fill up or something because Pulse would glitch out and like I'd get kicked out of TeamSpeak and everything else. So it was bad.
Usually, the creative Sound Blasters are like the generic chipset that everything's based off of.
This isn't a Sound Blaster, it's an Audigy X-Fi.
Okay. So it is the higher-end model, I guess that's why.
It was the higher-end model several years ago. It's pretty old now. It did work, though, which is more than it's done in Linux before. It used to not even work at all. It just wouldn't get picked up. But okay. it had problems. So I found a C Media card that I had kicking around, and it worked, and it would have been fine. It just wasn't. I'll explain it a little bit later when we get into the discussion. But it for what I needed, it wasn't good enough. I mean, it worked. It had noise issues.
Sure.
When recording with it, it actually had on one channel a DC offset, like it had some voltage on the right channel of its microphone. So
weird. How the hell could you tell that?
Huh?
How could you tell that?
I pulled up some audio monitors because I was going to. I'll explain it a little bit more when we get done with his feedback here. Let's get back to his. Because it will take a little bit of explanation here. He did go into a pretty lengthy explanation that he runs Arch on his desktop, but he didn't think it would be a good server due to the rolling updates. And for what most people think of when you talk about a server, he's absolutely right. You don't want to be doing rolling updates on a system that you need to work every day because pretty much you want to be able to set it up and leave it that way and only do like security patches. So something like a CentOS or a Debian for a long-term low interaction server absolutely is better. By low interaction, I mean low administrative interaction. I don't mean, like, not busy.
Exactly.
In that line, I run CentOS servers at work for the most part, and the back end of the G15 server is actually Debian. So just, straight up Debian 6, I believe. So, he's absolutely right in that. When I was talking about using Arch as a server, that's like for a LAN party or I'm testing something. So long-term maintenance isn't something really I'm thinking about. So, it's a good point he made about not using Arch as a long-term server. But you're trying to build something quick or test something, of course, they've got the latest packages and the repos, and it's a very clean, very quick system. And, for building like a low latency, like especially like a Team Fortress server, I guess I should... The thing I was building on Arch was actually World of Warcraft servers, private World of Warcraft servers.
That's cool.
And I tell you what, out of the three or four of us who was putting them together, they always wanted to come back to my systems because mine would actually run correctly. And I was building them on top of Arch, and they were very minimal installs. It was literally what it needed to run the server and a little bit of convenience software, things like HTOP. And a couple of little command line oddities that I like to have on a system, and that was it.
Is that the server where I logged in and every mob near Undercity agged to me just from start?
Yeah, but that was a configuration problem. That wasn't.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, that was I screwed up the database. I think that was the same server that we spawned Anixia. Changed your model to a rabbit, set the size correctly, and left it in one of the starting areas.
Nice. It had a very low aggro radius, so you had to piss off the bunny. I think someone eventually did.
Somebody did, because they were trying to figure out why there was this 7-foot-tall bunny going around the farm. And I went over and said, I can attack this. And they did.
Cool.
So, I've made a huge mistake.
Black.
Yeah, especially on like a level 2 character, right?
So, yeah.
But anyway, cool. He sent us in the email. Matichi had a pretty good little paragraph here, so I thought I'd go ahead and just read this one out. He said he prefers Linux over Windows, partly because he thinks Microsoft is pretty shady and he doesn't trust them. And, you know, you probably should trust the people you're getting software from. But also because he thinks Windows is extremely bloated, which, you know, which software isn't bundled with adware nowadays? Even Java comes with the AS toolbar in Windows. He also thinks it's a lot easier to do development on Linux because of the terminal and how easy it is to install additional packages, especially things like Python. Obviously, he's never had to deal with Perl dependency hell. But I think he's right. The Linux ecosystem is a hell of a lot cleaner than Windows.
What's Perl dependency hell?
Well, I guess I've never had that either because, I usually use, like, CPAN, right? You, like, hey, CPAN, install this Perl module for me, go, and it does it all.
Yeah, the thing is, though, that works, except if you've got part of your Perl modules managed by CPAN and the other part of them are managed by your package manager, had Red Hat updates just destroy applications because they, you know, knocked out half the Perl modules and brought in versions that weren't compatible, and oh, you want to talk about a fucking headache.
Yeah, that would be a nightmare.
But So if you're going to do Perl dependencies, you want to get all of them from your package manager or all of them from the CPAN. And your distro is going to, if you install Perl from your repos, you're going to get bits of them from the package manager, so you really just want to go grab the files and install it from source.
Right. That makes sense,
So, yeah, Madman asks, what's Perl dependency hell? That's where you are trying to get a set of Perl applications working, and they keep telling you you need a particular module installed or library installed, and you've installed the library, but for some reason the version of Perl you're running can't see it, and so, or it's the wrong version, or that library has another library dependency, and you can find yourself running in circles trying to get this shit to work.
Yeah, I've had that happen with RPMs, like this obscure, trying to compile. Yeah, trying to compile something from source, and it's like, oh, I need this version of this dev library. Okay, go grab that. Oh, I need this. Oh, I need this and this. And it's like, oh, God, when will it end?
It's the exact same. My favorite is when you get to the end of that loop, and it's asking you for some package that, you know,
from 1994.
Yeah, well, I've had that one too. But my favorite is when you get down to the very end and it's asking you to install the package that you were trying to install back at the beginning.
Oh God,
I've had the circular dependencies before, and you know that's what you awful. End up having to do is you end up having to tell RPM to force install one of the packages somewhere in the loop, and you can usually get out of it, but. Yeah, you know, the dependency hell is a thing. It just doesn't come up as much as it used to.
Right. So, that's actually one thing I've thought about trying out Arch because I hear it is really, really quick. Because you know you're basically
it's so clean. It is such a clean
very,
distro.
Very clean and everything like that. And the other thing that is cool about it, like you said, is it's a rolling release, so there isn't a certain set. Date release, which is one thing that pisses me off about. I've run Linux Mint at work normally, and I'm running Mint 12, I want to say, which is not supported anymore. They're on 15, so I've never had any luck doing their distro upgrade. So that's
they don't even support them anymore.
No, I
didn't realize that when I decided to go Mint. That essentially in the forums they tell people. Just reinstall.
Yeah. That's crappy. So I'm running that version I haven't felt like reformatting. I mean, Ubuntu was the same way. I ran that on my laptop a long time, and tried to do total distribution upgrades, even if it's just one version. I mean, sometimes they work. Other times, your system doesn't boot. So it's just. That part about having the every 6 month release is really annoying. So that would definitely appeal to me about Arch.
I always find it has to do with how crazy have you gotten your system. Like if you've set up a Linux system, say a Ubuntu box, and you've installed a handful of packages and you're only doing, a couple of things with it, all you do is run your Firefox web browser and you know, you would get a handful of extra packages installed, and it's just extra software. It's not like anything crazy in the system or drivers or custom compiled stuff. A lot of times the distro upgrades work fine, but it's like, you know, you've gone in and pinned packages to keep something working. You've done, you know, kind of a custom config. You've ever installed the kernel headers.
Well, that's the thing too, is like the way you start going down that crazy path when you need hey, this new version of this program came out. Oh, it's not in the repos yet. Okay, let me go set up the PPA. And then you've totally thrown the package manager out of the loop, and now you're just using the PPA. Well,
no, the PPA is part of the package manager. It's just a different source.
It is, but from what I've seen, between it and like the official distro packages don't always line up together. You know what I mean?
That's true. That's very true. Yeah. So, I guess we're just kind of rolled right into the first discussion topic on, you know, I am running Linux full time. I have been for about a week now. And so far, so good on most things. I'm getting annoyed with KDE. In fact, I just had KDE crash out my system trying to move about 60 gigs of data off my backup drive back onto my main system. And the file manager actually fucking crashed out. So I'm copying everything in the console right now, and it's working fine. In fact, it's done. Awesome. But yeah. So I'm getting kind of annoyed at KDE, but that's a KDE thing. So, but
yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm not particularly that big on KDE. I've tried it. It's gotten better, but I know there's always the KDE versus GNOME fanboys and arguments and all that. But
well, I can't stand what they've done with GNOME 3, so I thought KDE was a good choice.
And, but have you checked out Mate?
That's yes, I have checked out Mate, and I like Mate.
Yeah,
and
that's what I use.
I just got done dropping the packages on my system to run to Mate, and I just haven't switched my session over yet.
Yeah, that's cool and all. I've messed with XFCE and some other sessions managements like that, and the thing that's irritating is they all install in the same system, so they all try and recognize the different packages that you have on your system.
Yeah, you end up with a crazy ass menu.
Yeah, exactly, and it's annoying. It's like, okay, I'll go and try this out. Okay, you know, that's okay. I don't really want to. I want to switch back. Oh, look, I have all this extra crap installed now. Now how the hell do I get rid of it all, you know? Do I go package by package and remove it, or that's when it's, you know, easier to try a new distro, try every single, what's the right word for that? Is it window management? Or
desktop manager, window manager.
Desktop manager, you know? Try them all, figure out which one you want, reformat again.
Well, I used to really like KDE, especially 3. But, you know, I just, fuck, I don't care anymore. I do most of my heavy system shit I'm doing in Terminal Enemy, so I don't actually care.
Right.
The only reason KDE is getting annoying is I'm having applications actually crash out on me. I've had the desktop. I've had Xord crash out on me a couple of times, but I think that has more to do with Wine, like running Payday 2 and then, you know, hopping out of it. But I've had some problems with some of these KDE components, so I think I'm just going to hop over to Mate for a bit and see if KDE gets their act together again or not. But I don't know. They've been on this 4X build for a while now, and I thought they had most of this crap worked out, but apparently
that's
not.
That's what I had heard, but so, I don't know. I guess they're depending on how you're using it or whatever.
Yeah. But anyways, I'm starting to explore some more native Linux stuff, especially the native Steam. And I've discovered on a 64-bit system, it crashes a lot.
That's unfortunate.
It's Flash. It's Flash.
Wow. Oh, really? Yeah.
It's trying to run the 64-bit version of Flash for some reason. And so I found a little write-up on some guy's orcutils.wordpress.com. I'll get the link in the show notes. Of how to fix this, and
cool.
I'm gonna be doing that here probably Saturday, but I've still got a crap ton of tweaking I gotta do. And like I said, I wrote the show notes before I did this. I just dropped in Mate,
it's really too bad that, you know, native Linux Steam is just running Flash. Like, that's, I don't know. I feel like
people should have just store pages.
Well, even so, like, I feel like Flash is kind of a thing of the past almost at this point.
You do realize Steam is just a web browser, right?
No, it's true. Yeah.
So
it's still painful. And, you know, well, it's really unfortunate that it doesn't work really well on Linux.
Yeah.
Yeah. How has it been otherwise? I mean, playing games, have you played any Linux native games? I haven't tried it yet. I'm triple booting my system.
Yeah.
So I've got,
I was playing, of course, I played some of the Wine games. You saw me playing Payday 2 last night. And I was playing Open Arena earlier and just laughing at how terrible some of the models are. So, yeah, no, the Linux native stuff usually works fine.
Cool.
Yeah, I've had KDE applications giving me problems, but a lot of the other stuff, it just works and hasn't really been a problem. And, you know, for dealing with some of these little issues, I don't see it forcing me back onto Windows. You know what I mean?
That's good. I mean, as long as you... That's why I haven't been able to make this switch, is just the... I play, you know, a lot of games with you guys, and it's, you know... I guess I've heard, like you said, Wine has gotten a lot better. I haven't tried it in a while, but back when I did...
The one in the repos is fucking old, but if you go and actually add the Wine, the official repository, you can install a more modern version, and it does a lot better.
Okay.
So, it still doesn't have all of DirectX supported. Like I think it still ends up putting you in DirectX 9 mode for everything. But it's
at least
looks
it
like
supports DirectX.
Yeah, it supports it fairly well. So, and you know, there's a crap ton of tweaks for everything out there. So,
you know, and that's like Sard says. That's another. That's really what's been preventing me from really getting into it. Is just, you know, I've got all these things that I only use in Windows that I really don't want to lose, but it's almost just, you know, it's just a hit that you've got to take. Like, if you want to make sure your system's secure and you're not sharing your data with all kinds of random people who might be watching you and all this other sort of crap, it's just a small price to pay. Like, you can still do probably like 80-90% of everything that you could do otherwise on Windows. Well, probably 100% if you go out and actually do the work and find all the alternative software and stuff like that. But yeah, it's just a lot of work.
Well, I guess to explain a little bit, you know, the problems I had with the sound card, I actually ended up going out and buying a Focusrite Scarlett 2i, which is a fairly pricey sound card, but I made sure that it was one that was going to work, and it does. You just plug it in, and boom, also sees it. You can hook Jack up to it, and I've got Pulse talking to Jack, so switching all these sound cards out was actually not a pain in the ass at all. Like, on Windows, every time I swapped around the sound card, I had to reconfigure every individual application.
Yeah.
No, on this, I fixed Jack on the back end, and everything else just talks to Jack, so it's just like... It's nothing to do it, but this thing works and is, you know, super clean on recordings. Because one of the big reasons I wanted to switch to Linux is I wanted to explore all the audio applications that are on Linux on Jack, because they're not, it's such a completely different paradigm than on the Windows or the Mac side that I really wanted a good chance to play with it and see what's better. And so far I'm liking it. And the fact that all these applications are free, which is hilarious to me, that I'm thinking, I just spent $150 on replacing a perfectly good sound card with one that was compatible with Linux so I could use free applications. Like, I could have just went and bought, you know, for what I spent on the sound card. I could have just went and bought the software.
Yeah, but like you said, I mean, it's cool to use a different architecture because you know they aren't going to be ported over to any other OS, and what am I going to say? I just lost my train of thought.
Well, the current setup I'm playing with right now, audio-wise, is I'm still using Renoise as, you know, like my DAW, but I'm also playing around with one called Q-Tractor, which is... It kind of looks like Reaper, actually. So, it's like a DAW, but it's open source. It's on top of Jack. It's free, and it looks like it does a lot of what Reaper does. And I'm sure there's somebody who's like really, really good with Reaper who's looked at this, who's just screaming at me right now. But I'm still scratching the surface. So don't, you know, nobody flip their shit over me making comparisons here. But the idea I've had for a little while now is iPad apps that are like synthesizers are cheap, and, you know, especially compared to like buying Reason or you know, Massive or any of the other normal soft synths are crazy expensive. But and Renoise is primarily a sample based piece of software. So why not just sample the iPad apps and make your music that way? And
that makes sense.
To do that, you have to make very good recordings.
Yeah.
Like, this is how I figured out the C Media card had a problem. Was I was sampling some drum kits out of an iPad app, and I went in to clean up the samples, and all of them had obviously audible pops on the right channel, right? So I go pull out some monitoring software, and I figure out that the right channel's got noise on it. And I'm like, well, shit, what's going on here? So I unhook everything from the C Media card, so it's just the card, right? There's nothing hooked into it, and there's still noise on the right channel. Like, well, crap, that means there's something, you know, there's something with this card that's not cool.
Okay.
I go and try the USB card that I took with me to Gen Con, and its problem was a little bit different. It worked, but its amplifier on the line in was different on its two channels. Again, it was the right channel because that was the one I was monitoring that I noticed it on, but its left channel was significantly quieter than the right channel. Now, that's easier to fix than the line noise being in the card, but it's still like, I don't want to have to deal with that, you know what I mean? I don't want to have to fix that every time.
Yeah,
I don't even understand how that's even possible. Like, how do they design a piece of hardware?
It's cheap.
Yeah, but like, wouldn't they be using like the same components for each channel? Like,
it must have two amplifiers on one chip, but still two amps,
right?
So, but anyways, so, you know, to do the sampling and some of the audio work I was wanting to do, I had to get a better card. So, I went and got this Focusrite guy, and I'm going to be putting the Steinberg one up on eBay, but there's no point in hanging on to it now. But anyways, so I do have another story here for some Linux hardware, which you guys, I think Suave, you've heard this one already, but I'm fairly certain Madman and Sard have not. So this is hilarious, right? So I ordered a monoprice tablet, you know, a drawing tablet, like a Wacom.
Okay.
The monoprice tablets are rebranded UC Logic tablets. And everything I was finding on this is saying that pretty much on a modern Linux kernel, it should work right out of the box. So, you know, mine comes in, I unhook it, I plug it all up, and it doesn't work. And it's like, well, shit. So it's like, well, okay, this thing probably needs a driver of some sort. Let's start the Googling. So I go searching, right now, I find something called the Wizard Pin driver that hasn't been updated since 2011 and doesn't seem to have a modern repo. So, fuck it. I'll just build it from source, right?
Right.
So, I go grab the package, grab all the dependencies, get it all built up and installed, and the tablet still doesn't fucking work. So, I mean, I've dicked around with HAL configs, XORG configs, I've reinstalled WizardPin a couple of times, and in doing all of this, and then the cleanup afterward, I nearly borked my whole install.
I hate that.
You know, I'm sitting there screwing around with all the hardware detection, and I'm dropping config files here, there, and everywhere, and I thought XORG wasn't going to come back at one point.
Yeah.
So, you're reading ahead in the notes, aren't you? I already hear you laughing. So, after all this, I'm going back to look at the boxing, and maybe I've got a defective tablet, so I'm getting ready to wrap the damn thing back up. And I'm looking to see if I'd missed a power cord or something anywhere, right? And I find a AAA battery in the bottom of the box. And the AAA battery goes in the stylus. Oops. So, after cleaning all the mess up, plugging in the battery, and boom, the whole damn thing works. Essentially, what would have been out of the box, because I put it all back to default, right?
Right. Hopefully. And, that's the other part, is like, what the hell did I do when I was trying to make this shit work?
This is why you use a little program called Script. Screen and Script when you're doing shit in the Linux terminal that you're not sure of, because it'll save a fucking file that's a log of everything you did.
Yeah.
So, anyways, so yeah, with my paint and the GIMP, it just works right out of the box. Kirta, which is the artist application I was actually wanting to use the most, they don't have non-Wacom support just yet. But there's a wiki called Digimend, D-I-G-I-M-E-N-D, which is nothing about, you know, it's nothing but tablets on Linux. And they've got some stuff in there about using the Wacom driver with the UC Logic tablet. So I may give that a try and see if I can get Kirta working with it. But I may just say screw it and use my paint. So, but the damn thing works. So, but yeah, I was assuming it was because I was on Linux and I was going to have to do all this wacky, crazy shit. You know, drop config files and build drivers. And no, I just forgot to put the fucking battery in the stylus.
I still say, like, when you know a lot about computer systems, it's really easy to overlook the really simple solutions.
Oh, yeah. Because
you immediately dive into, like, the most complex issues, or just, like, the issues that you think it's going to be. But, you know, most of the people in our group have done stupid things like this. Like, I once spent, like, an hour troubleshooting a computer when the keyboard was unplugged. I think BSV went out and bought a brand new monitor when he had a bad HDMI cable. No, it was a new video card.
I think he rebuilt that whole computer, didn't he?
it was bad.
He spent a lot of money and like rebuilt a whole system because of a bad VGA cord or something like that.
Well, to be fair, I think he also wanted an excuse to build a new system. But
good excuse, still. Right? But yeah, I mean, it was...
Check your connections, people. Yeah. Check your cables. Check your batteries.
I don't know about you guys. I always get annoyed when the first thing when you got to deal with anybody, it's like, okay, can you unplug it and plug it back in? Make sure it's plugged in real good. Yeah. Like you think I don't know how to plug in a fucking USB cord? I mean, really? Yeah. Oh, apparently I don't. Fuck.
Oh, shit. So. Well, it's the same way with math. I'm sure everyone that's you start doing calculus and all that, and you go back, do some simple algebra, and you're like, what? I don't divide by 2 again? What the fuck is this? You know, your brain just switches out of that mode, I guess, you know.
I don't identify with this. I pretty much gave up on calculus.
Math and they said hard. 1 plus 1 doesn't always equal 2 for greater values of 1. I just said you're on fucking crack and left. Like, greater value of 1? 1 is 1. Let me show you this in reality here.
See, 1 fist, 1 face. Anyways. So, second topic I had tonight, because I actually didn't intend to spend the first half hour of the show talking about Linux, but I guess we're going to end up doing that, like, a lot. So, sort of like the same thing as smartphones, right? Like, I think we spent like the first 6 episodes of Decking doing nothing but talking about smartphones.
Yeah, but you know, it's things that everybody uses, and it's valuable information, so there's nothing wrong with that.
So, what I was thinking we'd have some fun with is out-of-band comms. And, of course, by out-of-band, we mean anything that's not going through your big corporate centralized server, you know, i.e. Google, Microsoft, you know, et cetera, right? So, Yahoo. You know, and of course, by that definition, our TeamSpeak server counts.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I had two in mind when I was thinking about this, which was RetroShare and BitMessage. And we've talked about both of these a little bit before because we did BitMessage in a Digital Dojo. But, you know, so Suave was the one who kind of found RetroShare, and he's been pushing the group to kind of get it set up. And it's certainly not the fastest thing in the world, and it's not the most straightforward thing in the world. Mm-mm. But it does do real-time chat, it does do files, and its encryption is all based on PGP. And it's more like a group-based thing, like somebody has to be invited to the group, and then you can speak, you know, you can send messages to the group, you can share files with the group, right?
Yeah.
Whereas
right,
because
you have to trade keys.
Right, you actually have to trade PGP keys. Or it's not PGP, it's GPG.
But it's defined as a friend-to-friend network as opposed to a peer-to-peer. So you have to actually know the person that you're sharing with. Now, you can set it up so you can share with a friend of a friend of a friend, but all of those people down that chain have to know each other along the chain.
Yeah, you actually have to... You can't just get on the network and search through people's shit. You actually have to be invited into their group.
Yeah.
Right.
See, now then you have BitMessage, which is more of an email replacement, right? So you don't need this whole group to get things working. You just need, you set up the client, you get your address, and you just need somebody else using BitMessage to test it with. But as far as I can tell, it's not great for doing file transfers. Like, I guess you could attach a file to an email or a BitMessage, but their encryption is not proven. So it's certainly out of band because it's not going through a server, but the encryption's not proven, and it looks like it'd be potentially easy to get your hands on the encrypted message. So I'm not knocking BitMessage because their encryption could eventually prove out and be fine. I'm just saying that it's not, and they actually have it right there on their wiki page. That, look, our encryption has not been tested. We would love somebody to actually come in and do a proper test of this. So, I mean, these are the two I kind of had in mind when we were talking about out-of-band comms. So I guess this kind of, before we even get into picking apart these things, do you think we even really need them?
Hell yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's the way the world's going to go to. I mean, try and decentralize everything. And run your own, at least for me. I mean, I'm glad that we don't use Skype anymore. I'm glad we don't use, you know, any other protocols or whatever. Yeah. You know, it goes that whole feeling of moving back towards dark nets, having your own personal internet. So that's kind of what RetroShare reminds me of. It's, you're going to have to know someone to get into this group, and then all those people are connected, and all those people can do whatever they want, communicate freely within their little circle. Everything's encrypted. Yeah. You have to know someone to get in, essentially.
Well, sure, but I mean, yeah, the NSA is monitoring everything, but at the end of the day, we're not actually a police state yet. I mean, they could flip the switch.
Well, that's debatable.
They haven't. They're not, like, they're not coming in here and shutting us down in G15 because we don't have a broadcaster's license, right?
Right.
Right.
So we're not actually a police state, but you can see it from here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that. But then you have places like Syria, where, like, didn't they just turn internet off not too long ago in a big city for a little while?
The country for a little bit, because that's how the rebels were communicating and getting messages out.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's happened in Egypt. It's happened in, you know, obviously we're not in situations like that. So, you know, for most people are not going to care. Right?
Question is, do you want to wait till we're in that situation? And do you see us ever going into that situation?
I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here. I'm trying to draw it out of, why do we need these kind of shit? You know what I mean? I mean, because you're right, obviously, that, you know, we don't want to wait till they're in that situation to, you know, suddenly try to get around and get away from the monitoring. But, I don't know about you guys, but talking with people about some of the stuff, I mean, everybody's like, yeah, this sucks. And then they're right back on, you know, their Gmail or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of it, too. I still use Gmail for a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So,
but, you know, like, I only use it because I don't really have anything to hide. You know, like, I guess that's
terrible logic, but...
Oh, no, absolutely.
I use it because I'm fucking lazy and just haven't bothered to set up anything better yet, but...
Yeah, it's, you know, it's mostly just an inconvenience at this point if I wanted to switch over, because, you know, I'd have to go through, like, 10,000 different services and change my email address on their systems and all this other sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm just lazy. That's really what it comes down to, and I'm sure that's what it is for the vast majority of people. Nobody really likes it, but we're all kind of just, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's a horrible way of looking at it, but that's kind of how it is right now. Now, as soon as doors start getting knocked down for, you know, saying a bad key word or something like that, that's going to change really fast, because there's a lot of good solutions out there, and... I think it's really about time that people really start looking at alternatives. Like, when it comes out that company or service that you're using is doing shady dealings, you need to get the hell out. Like, and I know I'm kind of a hypocrite at saying this, but that's where it's coming to.
Almost need a digital bug out bag.
Yeah.
Well, my thing is, doors are being knocked on. It's just not widespread yet. In the States, we've actually bugged ex-military's homes, like broken into them and illegally bugged the shit out of them just because we thought a fingerprint might have matched the Spain bombing. The U.S. was completely wrong. The guy was innocent. Not only was he innocent, but he was on post in the United States when it happened. The U.S. ended up paying him like $5 million just for screwing with his life for 2 years and covertly surveilling him.
Mm-hmm.
But it has happened. We have ignored our Constitution. We have violated individual civil liberties. I think it can get better, and I'm not going all doomsday, we need to overthrow the government, or the world's going to end type of crap, but I can see it getting worse a lot easier than I can see it getting better.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So, I can understand completely looking into being off the grid for messaging. I don't know how apt I'll be to move to it, but I understand people looking into it, and I think it's a good idea for everyone to check out.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think that's a good place to leave that. So,
actually, probably a good episode, you know, telling everybody what services are good to use and, you know, kind of get everybody pointed in the right direction. That's another big issue with people just not really knowing what's reliable and what isn't. And it's really tough, you know. But, you know, as a good rule of thumb, if it's based in the United States, it's, yeah. And even then, like, it just came out today, I think, Snowden just, you know, released another bunch of documents basically saying a vast majority of VPNs and a lot of, like, professional encryption software and stuff like that, it's completely unreliable. Like, they're at the point now where the NSA is essentially doing industrial espionage and getting people into positions in these companies where they can put in backdoors and stuff like that. So
both Amazon and Google have, like, employees dedicated to dealing with them now.
Yeah. So it's sketchy. It's really sketchy.
Yeah, that'd be one hell of a dojo segment, though, going through and figuring out what you can use and what you can't. I mean, there's the Prism Break website, but who runs that? So, you know, how much can you actually trust some of these things? Saying, oh, this service is good to use.
You know, it really, it's open source software that's completely transparent where people can go in and inspect the code.
And you need somebody who actually does. That's the thing.
Well,
I mean, sure, you can say the software is open source, but if nobody ever looks at the code, what's it matter what's in there?
Absolutely. It definitely takes a lot of diligence on everybody's part.
It takes so much that most people are just going to throw their hands up in the air and say, fuck it, whatever, I don't have anything to hide.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, let's go ahead and move on here to internet news. So first one up I've got is from Torrent Freak. And I just put this one in because I think it's hilarious. The Six Strikes copyright system or copyright alert system has been operational for half a year, but thus far has been no indication that U.S. traffic to the Pirate Bay and other torrent sites has been slowing down. In fact, the Pirate Bay enjoyed a record number of visits on the day the Six Strikes program launched, and monthly traffic to the site has increased significantly, more than doubling compared to 2 years ago. What a surprise. After years of negotiating and planning the Six Strike copyright alert system, it finally went live in February. The copyright alert system's main goal is to educate the public. People are informed that their connection is being used to share copyright material without permission, and they are told where they can find legal alternatives. These alerts start out as friendly, but repeat infringers face temporary, you know, they start changing the mask that the robot is wearing when he comes to your house to beat you up. these alerts start as friendly, but repeat infringers face temporary disconnection from the internet or another mitigation issue. Yeah, ISPs are actually going to tell people, we don't want your money anymore because you use BitTorrent. Sure.
Depends on the ISP. Ours just got it bought out by who?
Yeah, I know. I'm not pleased. The program has not yet shared how many people have been warned thus far or how many have been punished. But since these statistics are not available, we decided to look at another set of data to evaluate the effectiveness of copyright alerts. Ideally, the warning should stop people from downloading copyrighted content through sites such as the Pirate Bay, resulting in a drop in visitors. However, half a year has passed since the introduction of the Six Strike scheme, and U.S. Pirate Bay traffic appears unaffected. The Pirate Bay share... That's okay. I'm going to stop right here because that's the key of the article, that people aren't giving a shit about this copyright alert system.
Yeah.
And that's because the RIAA and the MPAA, they don't actually want to stop copyright infringement. They love copyright infringement because it lets them sue people and set the settlement rate for a couple thousand dollars so they can go around and blackmail people.
Yeah.
If it actually worked, if the program actually worked, they would actually lose a revenue stream.
True.
It's not a fantastic one. Apparently, their legal fees are more than what they're making off this, but I mean, still.
You know, they've been doing this for more than a decade now, and like piracy rates have just gone up and up and up for the last 10 years. You'd think that somebody would look at the numbers and realize, hey, wait a minute, we're throwing all of this money and all of this effort at this, and it's not doing anything. Hey, maybe we should adopt our business practices to, you know, fit the current digital ecosystem. But no, we don't want to do that. We're just going to keep suing people and dig our heels in.
Exactly. It's the good old boy system. It's a bunch of freaking 70, 60, 70, 80-year-old men there like, back in my day when we bought, you know, fucking 45 records, blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, we could do that, too, you know. Well, back in my day, we plugged the CD drive into the sound card. The fuck you talking about?
And you all laugh because
you know exactly what I'm talking about.
But we adapt. That's my point.
I'm not upset about not having to set IRQ jumpers. I mean, I'm totally cool with not having to do that shit anymore.
And I completely agree. Plug that shit in and go.
They could follow the Netflix model and put Netflix out of business, and I think it would actually drop piracy. The rates would go down. Just having content providers throw their own stuff up on a website and charge $4 or $5 a month to see it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because then you could play a la carte with it, right?
Yeah,
there's
well,
a
in
bunch
the long run,
Netflix,
I think they would make more money.
About.
Well, the reason that is Netflix has to go through the content providers to get the shit that they want, or the shit that they can get. They don't even get to pick what they play a lot of times.
That's true.
But if the content providers just threw it up directly, yeah, each individual viewing might give them less than a DVD, but at that point, no one would actually own copies of the content anymore for the most part. So if you wanted to see a movie, you would have to go back to the content provider. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Netflix, I actually got my Chromecast in today.
Nice.
Was playing around with that a little bit. It's kind of neat. I enjoyed it, and it got me thinking a little bit. Every Wi-Fi network I connect my phone to now, it's going to start. You know, if I start up the YouTube app or Netflix or anything else that's Chromecast enabled, it's going to start looking on the Wi-Fi network broadcasting, essentially trying to find any Chromecast available devices out on the network, which I think is a horrible idea.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh shit, all this stuff's all auto-discover on the Wi-Fi. So I can never connect this to any Wi-Fi connection but my home one ever again. Because how easy would it be to make a little device that listens for those Chromecast broadcasts that says, yeah, sure, I'm a Chromecast. What's your YouTube login?
Yeah, pretty much.
Or your Netflix login or anything else? Yeah. So... just a thought, since we were talking about Netflix, Sarah got me thinking about that. It's like, fantastic. I can't ever turn the Wi-Fi on this device again unless I'm home. So.
I think legitimate sources, if they took that model, piracy would actually go down.
I think it would, too. I think you're right.
My problem with piracy isn't that it's piracy as much as the connections aren't very reliable.
Netflix is easy. I mean,
it's easier than piracy.
A lot of times,
like it's really just a matter of content availability.
I was just gonna bring that up, dude, because I kind of disagree. Netflix isn't as easy because everything that you want isn't there. If it literally had everything,
is there, it's easier than piracy. It's really just a matter of if what you want to watch is actually there. Like the big problem is like a lot of the time they'll wait. Like a year after it comes out to DVD before it shows up on Netflix.
But then
and
you
if you're
get
like
something
into a
like
series
Crime Wire,
or something like that.
And they've got it all there, but the mm-hmm. sites they're on are shit, so.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention sketchy as hell. Like, you know, if you don't have like no script and ad blocked, you're probably going to get a virus from one of the ads being
Absolutely.
Served up on one of those sites. And actually, I just noticed a number of those sites, like Potlucker and stuff, have started like bitching about you using ad blocker. But there's a reason I'm using ad blocker. It's not to block the ads, it's to block the viruses.
And a shit ton of pop-ups.
Yeah. And so. And actually, you know, that the whole online advertising, it's you're actually more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to click on a banner ad at this point in time. Because everybody's been trained, because like all of these ads are so intrusive and annoying that people just automatically blank them out and stop paying attention to them.
You're rolling right into my next story here, so I'll...
Oh, sorry, I wasn't reading
that.
No,
you're fine. It's a good transition point, so let's go ahead and hit it. And then you'll be able to pick right back up with your conversation, believe me. So, everyone agrees that advertising on the internet is broken, said Till Fadia, CEO of AdBlock Plus, creator of by far the most popular ad blocking software on the web. The soft-spoken German visiting the San Francisco Bay Area to network and drum up support for his company's Acceptable Ads initiative sketches out a distressing scenario. Ads aren't generating enough revenue, so websites are forced to run even more aggressive ads. A maddening deluge of pop-ups, blinking banners, and autoplaying video and audio commercials. Actually, yeah, those autoplaying videos suck.
Yeah,
especially figuring out what tab they're in, because they wait like 10 seconds before starting.
That's a stupid mentality. It's not working, so what are we going to use?
The brute force method. More. Yeah.
The brute force method and shove it down their throats. You will consume.
Yeah, consume, breed, money is your god. Wait, wrong movie. Let's see. But as ads steadily become even more annoying, users click even less, forcing revenues down even further. This is creating a vicious circle, where at some point will lead to the whole system collapsing, said Fadia. Fadia believes that he can help avoid that apocalyptic scenario. It might seem a little strange here that the CEO of a company whose main product is designed to quash ads is dedicated to the goal of saving advertising. Certainly the owners of websites whose revenues are crimped by AdBlock Plus users could be excused for looking askance. But Fadia believes that he can leverage AdBlock Plus's marketing power. The company claims to have 50 million active users to create marketing incentives that force online advertisers to behave. It's a bold claim. When you look closely, there's a big catch, because AdBlock Plus's business model, the way the company plans to generate a profit, is to charge big advertisers a fee not to block some of their ads.
That means I'm going to stop using AdBlock Plus and start using the fork.
Using the fork of it, yeah.
Say goodbye to those 50 million users you had.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm skipping I already cut out huge chunks of this article because I wanted to find another write-up somewhere that wasn't Salon, because their write-up was huge. And I'm still skipping chunks of just a little bit I copied into the notes here. So here's how AdBlock Plus's Acceptable Ads program works. The AdBlock Plus community flags new ads as completely beyond the pale or as acceptable. A group of 200 or so open source volunteers then built AdBlock Plus filters designed to block ads that fall into both categories. But for most small websites, blogs, or news sites, the acceptable ads are whitelisted by default. That means they'll go right through. They won't be blocked. Any AdBlock Plus user can flip a switch, says Fadia, that blocks all ads, but only about 6% of the users follow through and do that. Large companies, said Fadia, are held to a different standard. To pay for the cost of operating AdBlock Plus for everybody, the company charges such advertising companies a fee to participate in the acceptable ads program. If they pay the fee, their non-obtrusive community acceptable ads will go through. So the author then goes through about basically tried to question the guy about, well, what happens if Google, for example, refuses to play ball with you? And apparently he never really got an answer. So that's what AdBlock Plus is now talking about doing.
Well, you know, I guess they're looking for a way to monetize their service, and that's fine. You know, I respect that. But I don't think that it's necessarily going to work. Now, if they do put in a good system where they actually have a group of people that review the ads and make sure that they aren't intrusive and they are, you know, just... Like, you know, a good example is like the little ads that Reddit throws on their site. And actually, I think they're a pretty good example of making advertising work, where, you know, like they're actually doing more like partnerships now. Like, for example, their Reddit Gold. It's this stupid thing where they're trying to make money on Reddit. It's like, what is it, $4 a month or something like that. But what it is it's now this thing where you go pay your $4 a month and you get access to all these deals from all these different websites. Where you get $20 off an order of $50 from this site, or you get 15% off on this site, or yada yada yada, and people will look at that and they'll see, oh well, you know, actually I like using that site, I might sign up for this service so I can get these deals, and so you got to have these like partnerships where you actually have value added for the consumer, and the thing about most of these advertisements you see on the internet, that's not it at all. They're just trying to ram stuff down your gullet, and that form of advertising is kind of defunct. And no longer working. It needs to be value added, otherwise it's just not going to work.
Well,
I don't even think it needs to be value added. I just don't like something that takes my attention away from the reason I went to the website. They have like a little ad on the side, just like a column of them. Mm-hmm. I might look over and see what they are and then check out if I want it, but I don't want an ad that pops up while I'm going to a website preventing me from actually using the website itself.
Right.
Favorite are the ones that black out the page and say, like us on Facebook.
Yeah. But, you know, like, there's a lot of good advertising that I see out there, and it's not banners, it's not, like, Google AdWords or anything like that. It's like somebody going onto a remote control car forum, and they're like, hey, we run this website, and we see you guys have this great community, so we're going to give your community, 10% off on our website to come, check out our stuff, because we like what you guys are doing here. And that right there will get way more hits than any advertising campaign you're ever going to do through Google AdWords or anything like that, because it's more of a personal touch. And it's that sort of interaction that's actually going to, well, hopefully, become the more successful form of advertising out there, where you're actually interacting almost on a one-to-one basis with the community. You're going to put yourself out there, answer questions, all that sort of stuff.
I don't think it'll work, because Groupon's going bankrupt, and that was their business model.
Yeah. Right.
The thing about it is I'm so tired of ads, especially the ones that go to great lengths to get around things like ad block and no script,
we'll
never put advertising on G15 ever, because it annoys me so much.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but I don't like it. I don't like the idea of trying to fund the website that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
I figure if we ever want to fund it, the way to do it would be like do the whole t-shirt thing.
Yeah.
Because then at least they're getting something, other than access to the site, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I don't know. I do have an alternative instead of Adblock Plus in the Digital Dojo section. So, seeing as we're already an hour into the show, I guess we'll kind of get moving here. So, the next one up is from The Register, and Sard sent me this one. The Federal Trade Commission has reached a settlement with U.S. wireless webcam manufacturer TrendNet that will commit the firm to third-party security audits for the next 20 years, plus 2 years of free technical support for its customers. The FTC began its investigation last year after a list of IP addresses over 700 TrendNet customers was posted online, allowing anyone to take a remote peek through the webcam's lenses. The company The company rushed out a security patch to fix the problem, but the FTC report said that TrendNet failed in several of the most basic levels of secure software and needed to be punished. The Internet of Things holds great really? Okay, we're going to stop right there. They're going to go into Buzzword City, and I don't even want to... What this is TrendNet's cameras did not properly lock down. You could screw with the URL and get into the thing without it punching in a password.
Oh, wow.
And the thing here is the FTC is actually punishing TrendNet for putting out an insecure device because it was a camera.
And that's what I... Yeah, exactly. That was the first time I've ever seen that happen.
I've seen it happen before, but the company usually was working with them, and it's more of a settlement deal. This is the FTC saying, thou shalt.
Right.
So, in the article, they go on talking about how TrendNet had not taken reasonable steps, and, now they have to be audited all the time, and, they were misrepresenting the security of their product. So, it's just interesting to me they're actually punishing the manufacturers now. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing to do.
No.
I my first thought, it kind of is, because it's like, if you start putting in checklists, the checklists are going to give a false sense of security, because checklists don't actually work when it comes to security. Security is a mindset. It's a process. It's not a, you know, have you, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? No. So, especially because it's like, well, they didn't check for this kind of attack. Well, what do you do in the, when whatever specific kind of attack is not on the checklist? Like, well, we met the standard, so we're good, but, you know, your devices still suck.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's a constantly evolving system. I think it really comes down to, if a security problem appears and it is not properly addressed, then action should be taken.
Oh, good God, you don't know the can of worms that opens.
Yeah, but, you know, that's kind of, like, if it's brought to your attention and there is a fix of, that is possible for it, and you don't make that fix, then you should be held accountable.
So Microsoft should be forced to patch Windows for Workgroups 3.1 because somebody's found a problem with it.
Oh, that's a good point.
But
if they release a new version of their software, you know, new Windows, that does address that problem, I think that's okay. You know, you can't be held accountable for old revisions of software, because obviously, like, old, outdated software is going to be full of holes. There's nothing you can do about that.
Well, but what you're saying is that since they should be held accountable, is that it shouldn't be.
No, I'm just saying that it should be, you know, like, if you come out with a piece of software and
forget the Windows example. You come out with something today.
Mm-hmm.
20 years down the line, you know, let's say this rule gets implemented and you come out with something the next day.
Yeah.
The rule gets implemented. 20 years down the line, should you be forced to patch that same piece of hardware?
No. But I think if, let's say 20 years ago you came out with a piece of software, and, you know, a year later, security holes found in that software. And a year after that, you came out with a new piece of software, like, you know, an updated version of that software, and you did not address those issues, then you should be held accountable. Because, you know, you've gone and you've come out with the new software, like, ooh, version 2.0, and it still has all the problems that were in version 1.0, then you should probably be held accountable, because this was brought to your attention, and you came out with a new version, but you didn't address any of these issues.
Let's see, what that makes me think, what they just do, is they're like, all right, we put this program out there, and some people find some vulnerabilities in it, and then next year, rather than coming out with 2.0, they say, oh, look, we made this new product. It's this. So they don't have to adhere to the bug fixes and things like that that they had in the other one. It's new and improved, but it's a totally different product.
Whatever happened to consumer watchdog groups that just said, this stuff's crap, don't buy it?
Yeah, that's essentially it.
That's,
see,
what
I'm just not sure
down
I was stepping
to. You
in.
Can't force people to do a good job at something. You just stop buying their product if it's crap.
You just have to warn people and say, hey, that shit is broken.
Like, this webcam service, if you use it, people are going to watch you poop.
Well, actually, there's a good fix for it. Instead of being held accountable for it, just to force them to make people aware that there's this problem. You know, when it comes in, just make sure that you've got the, you know, pop-up saying, along with the EULA and all this other sort of stuff. Of course, people don't read it, but at least you're putting it out there, saying, okay, well, you know, it is vulnerable to this and this and this.
Anyone remember when the news did that? Am I the only one raising my hand? I mean, I can't tell, because we're all on an audio service.
Yeah. All right. Well, like I said, I find it interesting that they're actually punishing the manufacturer. So I'm not sure that that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure it's a good thing either. You know what I mean?
I don't think it's particularly a good thing. I think the manufacturer should be forced, you know, admit that they have a crap product, or at least let people know that this crap product exists so they can go to an alternative. But once you put in the government can do something,
mm-hmm.
I see that being taken way out of control, not only in this industry, but in any other. But if I'm using a car that's 30 years old and I've never maintained it, does that mean Ford's up for being sued because they put out that car?
I mean, we're obviously picking crazy examples here, but yeah. That kind of stuff comes up eventually. And the whole, we're going to punish you for not maintaining a secure product. How do you even define what a secure product is? Now, in the case of TrendNet, you know, it's like, oh, well, they could easily bypass the security of the camera and watch you poop. Then, you know, obviously, that's a problem. But, I mean, you know, think about companies like Oracle and Microsoft and just the sheer amount of liability. They just wouldn't put out software anymore because it just wouldn't be worth the risk.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't want to stifle innovation either. That's the thing. So I like I said, I find it interesting that they're holding the manufacturer, you know, responsible for a bad security problem, and I don't disagree with that, but I'm not sure I agree with it either.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I can see there's definitely some unforeseen consequences to actually holding somebody responsible for that sort of stuff.
You know, plus two, they've all gotten their end user license agreement. You know, we're not responsible. Blah 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 blah, which I guess is not enforceable. But whatever.
Right. So, I was just gonna say those would explode. I mean, they'd be 10 times as long as what they are now if that was.
Oh yeah.
The case.
I don't see the end user license agreement as even a way out on this one because it is an obviously defective product. I could see forcing refunds, like no matter how old your camera is from this company. They force a refund from everything prior to the date that this was announced. And that's the worst I would do to that company. Like, yeah. Treat it as a mandatory recall. But I can't see forcing updates or fixes. Can't, like I said, you can't force someone to put out a good product. That's what the market's for. They'll just go out of business and I'll buy my camera from someone that does a bit better job securing it. I don't want someone to watch me poop. Which I guess I would just wouldn't put a camera in my bathroom.
I guess there's websites where people are into that. I mean, I don't know, but so, anyways, next story up here. Last week, I had the story where they had noticed a sudden increase in Tor, but they didn't know what was going on. Well, now they've got a pretty good idea of what was going on. Recently, Roger Dingledine. I guess I'm saying his name right, Dingledine. described a sudden increase in Tor users on the Tor Talk mailing list. Today, there's been a large amount of speculation as to why this may have happened. A large number of articles seem to suggest this may be a result of the global espionage events, the invasion of the Pirate Bay blockades using the pirate browser, or the Syrian civil war. An alternative recurring explanation is the increased use of botnets using Tor. Based on the assertion that increase appears to be consistent with mostly new users to Tor that appear to not be doing much given the limited impact on Tor exit performance. In recent days, Foxit has found... Okay, I'm going to stop reading this. I'm just going to tell you what they found. They found a botnet called Mimvade A that older references called it the Sephant. But essentially, it's a huge botnet that just recently updated to include Tor functionality. And they picked it apart and found it in the code. So, yeah, it's a botnet.
I thought someone was listening to your show when we were talking about Tor to get away from government spying on you. It's like, yes, you have a measurable impact on the world.
I think we all would have liked it to be that, and all the people saying, you know, you guys should use Tor or something like that, encrypts it, but people just don't pay attention. It's.
I'm just thinking in terms of a sysadmin, how do you pick out the traffic that's... I guess you look... Well, I'm seeing Tor traffic from your machine, but you don't have Tor installed.
It's true.
But,
ooh,
yeah.
That's a problem you'll have to actually look at.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Like,
yes, it is.
Now I have another way to track down botnets. I'm going to look to see if anything from our server cluster is going through Tor.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we've got a lot of kids using Tor. So, how do you pick out the legit... that's where you just start calling people. It's like, yeah, I'm seeing odd traffic from your machine. Are you running Tor? Oh my God, is this the FBI?
No, I'm from the school, don't worry. I'm not going to block you. I just need to know, do you know this is happening? Because if you don't, you might have some malware.
If you don't, we're going to turn your internet off. If you do know about it,
Don't throw that in there.
And don't worry, the cameras. Don't worry, the cameras pointed in your room. Those are for your protection. But the guy with the shadowy figure with the glowing red eyes, he doesn't work for us. You might want to call the cops. Oh fuck. Okay. Yeah. They picked apart some botnet, some malware, and figured out that botnets are starting to use Tor for their CNC. So it's actually a interesting article. It just doesn't translate into audio very well. So that's why I'm skipping over a large chunk of it.
That just make them harder to find in general, or does it really? How would that affect the botnets? Is it just harder to block them now?
Yeah, it essentially makes them harder to locate, harder to block the. It makes the command and control channels harder to block. What a lot of the way they were shutting down botnets is they would figure out what servers the CNC channels are on and go shut those down or take them over. In fact, a couple of years back, the FBI was pretty much running the CNC channels for a large botnet because if they took them down, it would have broken all these machines. So they like didn't really know what to do with them except just keep them running for a bit.
Yeah, I don't understand
the machine owners that you have a botnet.
Yeah. Huh? Well, yeah. That's what they did. They redirected their internet traffic and said, hey, you need to download this. I don't know. It's just still weird to me that they spent all that time and money keeping that shit up.
What are you going to do?
Turn it off. Oh, my computer doesn't work. Well, you had fucking malware on there. What do you expect?
So, next one up is from the Online Sentinel. Google's attorneys say their long-running practice of electronically scanning the contents of people's Gmail accounts to help sell ads is legal and are asking for a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit that seeks to stop the practice. In court records filed in advance of a... Have I already done this story?
I've heard it on several news sources. Might have been you.
I'm thinking we did one just like this last week.
I don't remember...
Well, Google's argument is that they've been doing it for a long time, and because they don't, you know, it's all software, there's not actually a human sitting there reading their email, that they're legally allowed to do it.
I believe I made the argument of just because you've been doing it for a decade doesn't make it legal.
Yeah, we've done this story.
We've done a similar story.
I think it was when they brought it originally, they were trying to get the trial judge to dismiss it, and now they've appealed it to a higher judge.
Yeah. Because we've done this argument before because I specifically remember that argument of just because you've already done it for a decade doesn't mean it's legal.
And you know, like, it really comes down to, you know, is it some dude reading your email or is it an automated system scanning for the word attachment so it can tell you that you forgot to include your attachment? And you know, I think it should be down to the user to agree or disagree whether or not this should be happening. Because, you know, there is definitely some value-added services that can be included with this sort of service. You know, hence the attachment thing that they do. And that's actually been very useful to me in the past. And if it's just a algorithm scanning for that sort of stuff, I see no problem with it. It really just comes down to how far are they taking it.
I think Google should just be straightforward and saying, we're scanning your email. And then if people don't like it, they'll use something other than Gmail.
Yeah. But they kind of do. Right. They do say they scan through it when you open it up to show you ads.
Yeah,
they just don't announce it from the rooftops. It's kind of, you know, filed in the basement under the other paperwork.
There's no reason people have to sue them if it's straightforward. Whenever you're opening up your account or something, and your email, then you know, be prepared to have whatever happen. Mm-hmm. I suggest everyone open up Goatsy at least once a day just to freak out whoever's in Gmail. Job it is to look at your email. I mean, eventually he's going to get numb to that, so after a while, switch to hornymanatee.com.
Oh, God.
You're not going to watch the host's files I got here for you, but anyways.
Just randomly find something else horrible to freak out people at Gmail.
Just make them look at this stuff.
And if it wasn't automated to begin with, it will be automated quickly.
All right. Next one up is from Torrent Freak. As Russia continues its crackdown on online infringement, the government is now proposing even tougher measures against those who facilitate piracy. A new bill was approved yesterday, which allows for fines of up to $29,853 for service providers. How did they come up with that number? Oh, Russia. Dollars to... Okay, never mind. Let's go say what? That's
I'm going to go with Haven't you read Dilbert? All accounting numbers are arbitrary and random and spouted out by a troll.
I was going to say, that's a very strange number to pick for a... It probably rounds off when you convert it to... It, okay, anyways. Search engines to service providers, search engines, and users who fail to comply with the blacklist of sites already subjected to copyright complaints. Just over a month has passed since Russia introduced new legislation aimed at cracking down on online piracy. The law, which has become known as Russia's SOPA, takes a tough line with those offering or linking to illicit content online. Copyright complaints against a site or service can lead to that domain being added to a national block list, and if their operators fail to render the illicit content inaccessible within a few days. Although rights holders have struggled at times to provide necessary information required for a correctly formatted complaint, orders have already been issued to address to add sites to the Russian national block list. But now, just 34 days after the initial law was implemented, the government is pushing through further punitive measures for pirates and those deemed to be assisting them. According to Vesti.ru, a parliamentary committee approved a new bill yesterday which allow a range of internet entities to be fined if they fail to block content and sites as dictated by the country's blacklist. The bill, which was approved in the first of three planned readings in the state Duma, introduced fines of up to 1 million rubles, which is the, which is the $29,853, to be levied against search engines, web hosts, ISPs, and even regular web users. So I don't even need to read the rest of this. Russia is going nuts, and if you don't comply with their national block list, they're just going to fine you to death.
I wonder how long before government websites are on the block list and how you go about getting that process started. Because if it's automated at all, that can be done.
You file a copyright complaint against the government website.
Well, we've already seen that happen. Remember, there was NBC filed a DMCA complaint against one of their own websites? One of their
they filed one against themselves. Who was it that did VLC, too? That was...
Yeah, I think it was NBC. I think it was that same story or whatever. It was their own, and they did open source project VLC.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. It's just going to get abused all the hell. So, I'm just not sure I agree with the idea of, a national block list. And if you don't maintain the national block list, we will kick in your door and shoot you in the head. I mean.
Ridiculous.
It's up to content providers to sue people.
Yeah.
So, the last story I have up for tonight is hilarious. It's from NBCNews.com. A bill that would criminalize revenge porn.
What?
There's a phrase.
Damn it.
But what if I want to whack off to somebody blowing away a mobster?
Okay, that's not...
I'm thinking more like exgirlfriends.com, but
Nude or sexual photos, generally of former wives or girlfriends, posted online by an angry ex, could pave the way for other states to adopt similar laws, putting perpetrators in jail for 6 months if convicted of first time and up to a year for repeat violations. The bill, already approved by the California Senate, is expected to go to the state assembly as soon as this week, despite concerns from some lawmakers and experts who fear it could curtail First Amendment rights. It's traumatizing real victims. It's a growing problem, California State Senator Anthony Canella told NBC News. Technology moves much faster than our laws, said Canella, a Republican who authored the legislation. When we identify a problem...
I hate California. Figures. Of all the freaking states, it would be California. Goddamn
when we
hippies.
Identify a problem, it's our responsibility to deal with it. If passed by the Assembly, SB 255 will go to Governor Jerry Brown for approval. It's not clear whether Brown will support it. Generally, we do not comment on pending legislation. Who the hell is it that calls Jerry Brown Moonbeam? Because I almost called him that. Somebody calls him that as a nickname, and I can't remember where I first heard it.
No clue, man.
Oh, well. Anyways, Brown spoke, generally we do not comment on pending legislation. Brown press spokesman Evan Westrup told NBC News, in the era of instant uploads, a slimy sub-industry of sites has emerged that are dedicated solely to revenge porn shots and videos. It has become a money-making sport, of which one of the most notorious players is Hunter Moore, who is under FBI investigation for his controversial site, Is Anyone Up?
That's I almost want to name. Pull that up and see what it is. Love that name.
Is anyone up? Though the sites often include personal information about the victims, including names, email addresses, and even links to their Facebook profiles, the sites themselves are protected from liability because of Section 230 of the Federal Communications Decency Act, which says that websites and internet service providers cannot be treated as a publisher for any information provided by another information content provider. With a little legal recourse, these victims are left feeling helpless and humiliated. Jeff... You know, if they're good shots, they don't really have anything to be humiliated. Anyways, I'm just going to stop there because that's going
to
get
dark. If they're getting hit, then they're good shots. The woman has nothing to be ashamed of.
So, Jeff Hermes, director of the Digital Media Law Project at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, said a balance needs to be struck properly, and he is not sure the California law will do that. You need to be extremely careful in criminalizing privacy law because of the risk that you're going to deter legitimate speech, he told NBC News. With the California bill, I don't see an exemption here for material that's legitimately newsworthy. Take, for example, he said, circumstances where photographs exist of a political candidate who has run their campaign on their squeaky clean image, but there are photographs of that candidate in a compromising position. The distribution of these photos could indicate to voters that the candidate might be... So, in other words, we can't... We want to be able to use...
They want to show Anthony Weiner's wiener. That's what this guy's complaining about. It's like, I can't show Weiner's wiener anymore.
My question is, aren't there already laws against publishing images of people against their permission in, you know, lewd and lascivious poses?
I think so. Pretty much, there's several California... lawmakers who think that this thing is going to be a First Amendment violation, so they're not sure how well it's going to go because they think it's too broad. It's overly broad in the way it's written. So, well,
my thing is, if I spooge on a chick, she owns my spooge. If I'm able to convince her to let me take a picture, I should own that. That's my copyrighted material, and I'll submit it to whoever I want.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, can't, like, the paparazzi take pictures and publish whatever the hell they want, with or without permission, especially if the person's in a public place?
If it's in a public place, yes. So if I can convince my girlfriend to strip on a beach, I think this law wouldn't cover it?
I think the paparazzi have to be in a public place. I don't think the person they're taking a picture of has to be in a public place. As long as they're visible, then they're fair game. At least that's my understanding of it.
Well, I haven't
seen a lot of shots of people in their home, so I think
I've seen shots of people in their backyards.
Yeah, backyards are very visible, though, and cops can pop you for drinking in your backyard if it's not fenced in. It's still considered public intoxication.
Oh, not in Canada.
What, really?
up here, I remember when I was like 14 and drinking beer, hanging out on the front lawn of somebody's house, talking with the local cop, and he couldn't do fuck all because we were on private property.
Yeah, that's why they always say Red Solo Cups and their songs about them is, in the States, if the cop can see you drinking and is an asshole, they can pop you for public intoxication.
I see.
That's why, like at the barbecue festival, Morps will know this when it's something that happens around where we come from, the beer gardens always give you plastic cups because you can argue that it's not beer, even though it smells like beer, looks like beer, tastes like beer, because it's not advertised beer. They're covered.
It's near beer, sir, I swear.
Yeah, I'll straight up say it's Budweiser, but it's in a fucking cup and not the bottle, so fuck my ass. I mean,
wait. Let me rephrase that.
Why are you grinning and, oh, God. Okay, it's time to move on to this. that thing cracks me up. So for Digital Dojo, I thought we could talk about the hosts' files, especially since Adblock Plus apparently is not going to be the thing to use anymore. So... what I took a chunk from Wikipedia here talking about what it is. The host file is one of several system facilities that assist in addressing network nodes in a computer network. That is a very fancy way of saying that. Short version, it is...
It's DNS.
It's DNS, thank you. It's a very quick and easy way of saying this name belongs to this IP address. And it's what they used before DNS. And the part I wanted out of Wikipedia here, the ARPANET, the predecessor of the internet, had no distributed host name database. Each network node maintained its own map of the network nodes as needed and assigned them names that were memorable to the users of the system. There was no method for ensuring that all references to a given node in the network were using the same name, nor was there any way to read the host file of another computer to automatically obtain a copy. The small size of the ARPANET kept administrative overhead small to maintain an accurate host's file. Network nodes typically had access or typically had one address and could have many names. As local area TCP/IP networks gained popularity, the maintenance of host files became a large burden in sysadmin, and so they invented DNS. So, pretty much, your host file is the first place your computer goes to at an operating system level when it's trying to figure out what IP address the URL you just gave it lives at. So when you go to, say, google.com or galaxy15radio.com, your computer has no idea what computer actually that is. So it starts running down its list of trying to figure out what that name refers to, because what it wants is an IP address, you know, a numeric address. So the first thing it'll do is it'll check the host's file, because that's largely been left in for legacy use, but some people still use it for stuff. So it's a way of having names without running any kind of a network server, right? It's just a flat text file. And enough stuff still modifies it and people still use it that it's still in modern operating systems today. I mean, everything on the modern TCP stack has a host file. So if it's not in the host file, then it goes and checks your local DNS, and if the local DNS doesn't have it, it starts moving up the chain until it finally gets back the numeric address or returns a name not found error. So, and these days it's hard to get a name not found error because your ISP usually intercepts the DNS and hijacks it and shows you an ad. So, anyways, what you can do with the host's files is a neat little trick. Is you can put in the URL of a domain that you don't ever want your computer to talk to, and then put in a bum IP address, like, say, the localhost 127.0.0.1 or just 0.0.0.0. And so anytime anything in your system, not just the web browser, not just like, you know, where you've got your ad block installed, anything tries to connect to that name that you don't ever want to talk to, like ever, it'll return the wrong IP address. And so, you know, 127.0.0.1 or all zeros or whatever. And also, this is a great way to prank people, right? You know, go set up a web server on your network and then change your host files for like Google and Yahoo to point to your web server. So, you know, you can have some fun with people with that. But it's a local file on the computer, right? So it's not anything on the network. This means that if you maintain a host file that lists all the ad and malware servers, anything on the operating system, anything that's a browser, including things that shouldn't actually be web browsers, like Microsoft Word and Acrobat Reader, cannot connect to that URL because it's going to get the wrong IP address and it's just going to error out. And not only that, this method works on things like Android. So, you know, AdBlock Plus on Android is kind of a joke. I don't know if you guys messed with that much or not. But you drop in a modified hosts file, and it's every bit as good.
This is actually the first time I've heard about using the host file on Android. I'm fully aware of using it on a PC. I just never even considered using it on Android.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just awesome. And there's a ton of like pre-formatted host files out there that you can just go pull down that have...
Well, I've got two of them here, right in the show notes. The first one is, just because I love the URL, someonewhocares.org/hosts. It's a very large and reasonably maintained file. When I checked it, the last time he had updated it was the 23rd of August, so that's fairly good. And the host file itself, I mean, that page returns a hosts file, a valid host file. And in the comments at the top of it is a good set of instructions of how to install it. So you could actually write a little script to pull this thing down and drop it in every once in a while if you wanted. I don't recommend automatically updating your host file. And plus, by manually dropping in, you got a chance to customize it. He's got lots of blocks of addresses and comments that you can go through. Like, as an example, he's got the entries in there for blocking Google Analytics. But if you block Google Analytics, that'll break a lot of sites, and the websites won't be able to, you know, get good measurement of how many people are going there if a lot of people are blocking the analytics site. So he doesn't have it blocked by default, but the line's there. So you can uncomment it if you want that, if you want to block Google Analytics, right? So by going through it by hand every once in a while, it's not as fancy as the automated updated ones, but I think it's safer for one thing. Mm-hmm. Another one is at winhelp202.mvps.org/hosts.html. And honestly, I hated going through this thing because he's got crap all over this page. But he's got a good link to download his generated host file. And he's got a batch file in there for easily dropping it in place. So if you don't know where it goes, you can just run his little bat file and drop it in place. And he's got links to programs for managing the host file for you. And there are auto-updating managers out there for your host file, but I really don't think that's a good idea. Because this is system-wide, right? So one hacked web server and you're fucked. Because the prank I was talking about where you send somebody, you know, you remap Google to, say, Goatsy, you know, Yahoo to TubGirl or whatever. Yeah, sure, it's kind of funny to do it, but if you've got something automated going in and dropping in the host file, somebody else can do it to you. And in fact, a lot of malware will generate, will modify your host file so that a lot of popular sites go to bad guy servers, and fake antiviruses are notorious for this. One of my favorite fake antiviruses used the host file to redirect every major antivirus and cleanup tool web page to a page for the fake antivirus to buy the fake antivirus. And they had set up enough of these fake pages that if you tried to go to Norton to get, you know, or McAfee to get the Stinger tool, it would say that, oh, McAfee recommends you get this. Norton recommends you get this to clean this up. So, I mean, I loved that as a marketing ploy. It's like, oh yeah, no, you should totally. I mean, so the auto updating host files thing, I get a little twitchy on, because that's really easy to get screwed with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it makes sense for sure.
But the other fun thing you can do is, let's say you're managing a network, you can drop this host file in on your gateway servers. Or, well, I guess if you've got your own DNS server, you just do a custom DNS entry. But right. You can take the same concept. You can take these host files and drop them in your DNS servers to just block all these bad guy websites that you probably just don't want to talk to. Yeah. So, you know, even if AdBlock Plus becomes unusable, or, you know, they've got a way around NoScript, well, if your computer just won't connect to the server because it can't resolve the name, it doesn't matter. Not only that, it prevents things like Word or Reader, or, you know, hell, anything that runs a web browser these days, which is most everything, from connecting to these bad guy servers that you just don't want to talk to. So this is probably the much better way to go than relying on something like AdBlock Plus.
Yep.
So, I don't know. Sard, I know you've done host files before, man. What do you think?
No, just like you said, man, I agree. It's one way of combating that. Like I said, though, it is kind of a pain in the ass, just because it's static entries, and like you said, making the point of auto-updating IP addresses could potentially be abused, but, I mean, really anything could potentially be abused and used for nefarious purposes, but I know, I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, Spybot Search and Destroy had a plugin or had a mode where it would automatically update your host file also.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, I remember it did something.
Hmm.
Yeah.
For some reason, I never much cared for Spybot. I didn't use it much. I don't know why. I don't remember
what
it was.
Yeah.
I think one of the early versions must have sucked hard or something, and I just, you know, never went back to it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I had to use that quite a bit.
So. All right. So that's pretty much all I got. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. I think Big is working on some new bands. I think he was even talking about putting together a broadcast party at some point. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. The Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays. I Have Nothing on Saturdays. And the shadowy figure with the glowing red eyes following you home from work works for the disclaimer. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handles, the feedback form, the Sim on OS Grid, the subreddit, the IRC channel, even though I'm not sure anybody's even in there anymore. So
there is. I'm in it all the time. What up, awesome. Suckers? What up, Juver?
So, and of course, you know, I forgot to mention Let's Get Drunk sometime tomorrow. I'm going to do that one. That's pretty much all I got. And if anybody's got something they want to throw out before I hit play on this music, now would be the time.
I think you covered it. Although, why wait till tomorrow to get drunk? I've got more bourbon.
So you